Utah. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for a full-time, one-year paid news fellowship. Details online at democracynow.org. Special thanks to our crew here at Park City Television: Danielle Turner, Robbie Johnson, Diego Romo, Brendan O'Leary, Kristen Parker, Jacqueline Daly, Yudibia Barrios, Ethan, and Derek. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Charina Nadura, Tay Marie Astudio, Libby Rainey, Renee Feltz, and Dennis Moynihan. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, and Ariel Boone. Again, check out our website at democracynow.org for the full Sundance Film Festival coverage. I'm Amy Goodman from Park City, Utah.
WHFR is having another benefit party, and you're invited. Join us Friday, February 8th at the Ghostlight in Hamtramck for our Motor City Gems party. Performing will be The Dirty News, Labor Day Weekend, and The Kenny Hill Group. The Kenny Hill Group, who's also featured on WHFR's indie rock compilation, Motor City Gems, an 11-song showcase on beautiful blue vinyl. In addition to the music, there will also be a 50-50 raffle and station giveaways, including a copy of Motor City Gems. So come out of the cold and join us for some great music and support WHFR and local independent artists. For more information, call us at 313-845-9676 or go to planetant.com and whfr.fm. The Ghostlight is located at 2314 Kniff in Hamtramck. That's WHFR's Indie Rock Party, Friday, February 8th at the Ghostlight. See you there.
Listener supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Good afternoon and welcome to the WHFR Journal here at 89.3, also online at WHFR.fm. I'm Alan Mazurek. Susan McGraw has the week off. In fact, come to think of it, most of us here at Henry Ford College have had most of the week off, obviously due to a very bad stretch of weather that we've had here in Southeast Michigan and the Midwest as a whole. So while we had this time off, while Henry Ford College was closed for the safety of our students and employees and all of that. Of course, it gave us lots of time to sit back and go through our Twitter feeds and our Facebook feeds and our Instagram feeds and see all sorts of people thanking global warming for this terrible stretch of cold weather we've had the past few days. And that sort of inspired today's edition of the WHFR Journal. We're going to go through some TED Talks, which we occasionally do on the program. This around the theme of global warming and climate change, just so for once and for all we can be clear about the difference between weather and climate. We found a few scientists and even a meteorologist to talk about these kinds of biases, and we're going to start things off with a talk that was given by meteorologist J. Marshall Shepard. This comes from TEDx in Georgia about confirmation bias, the Dunning-Kruger effect, and cognitive dissonance impact impacting what we think that we know. And it is a TED Talk that was given in March of last year, March of 2018 at the University of Georgia. Three kinds of bias that shape your worldview. J. Marshall Shepard's TED Talk here on the WHFR Journal.
Now, I'm a meteorologist by degree. I have a bachelor's, master's, and PhD in physical meteorology. So I'm a meteorologist, card carrying. And so with that comes four questions, always. This is one prediction I will always get right. And those questions are, Marshall, what channel are you on? Dr. Shepard, what's the weather going to be tomorrow? And oh, I love this one. My daughter's getting married next September. It's an outdoor wedding. Is it going to rain? Not kidding. I get those. And I don't know the answer to that. It's just the science isn't there. But the one I get a lot these days is, Dr. Shepard, Do you believe in climate change? Do you believe in global warming? Now, I have to gather myself every time I get that question, because it's an ill-posed question. Science isn't a belief system. My son, he's 10, he believes in the tooth fairy. And he needs to get over that, because I'm losing dollars fast. But he believes in the tooth fairy. But consider this. Bank of America building there in Atlanta. You never hear anyone say, do you believe if you go to the top of that building and throw a ball off, it's going to fall? You never hear that, because gravity is a thing. So why don't we hear the question, do you believe in gravity? But of course we hear the question, do you believe in global warming? Well, consider these facts. The American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS, one of the leading organizations in science, queried scientists and the public on different science topics. Here are some of them: genetically modified foods, animal research, human evolution. And look at what the scientists say about those, the people that actually study those topics in red, versus the gray, what the public thinks. How did we get there? How did we get there? That scientists and public are so far apart on these science issues. Well, I'll come a little bit closer to home for me, climate change. 87% of scientists believe that humans are contributing to climate change. But only 50% of the public? How do we get there? So it begs the question, what shapes perceptions about science? It's an interesting question, and one that I've been thinking about quite a bit. I think that one thing that shapes perceptions in the public about science is belief systems and biases. Belief systems and biases. Go with me for a moment, because I want to talk about three elements of that: confirmation bias, Dunning-Kruger effect, and cognitive dissonance. Now, these sound like big fancy academic terms, and they are, but when I describe them, you're going to be like, oh, I recognize that. I even know somebody that does that. Confirmation bias. Finding evidence that supports what we already believe. Now, we're probably all a little bit guilty of that at times. Take a look at this. I'm on Twitter, and often when it snows, I'll get this tweet back to me. Hey, Dr. Shepherd, I have 20 inches of global warming in my yard. What are you guys talking about climate change? I get that tweet a lot, actually. It's a cute tweet. It makes me chuckle as well. But it's oh so fundamentally scientifically flawed, because it illustrates that the person tweeting doesn't understand the difference between weather and climate. I often say, weather is your mood and climate is your personality. Think about that. Weather is your mood, climate is your personality. Your mood today doesn't necessarily tell me anything about your personality, nor does a cold day tell me anything about climate change, or a hot day for that matter. Dunning-Kruger. Two scholars from Cornell came up with the Dunning-Kruger effect. If you go look up the peer-reviewed paper for this, you will see all kinds of fancy terminology. It's an illusory superiority complex, thinking we know things. In other words, people think they know more than they do. Or they underestimate what they don't know. And then there's cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is interesting. We just recently had Groundhog Day, right? Now, there's no better definition of cognitive dissonance than intelligent people asking me if a rodent's forecast is accurate. But I get that all of the time. But I also hear about the Farmer's Almanac. We grew up on the Farmer's Almanac. People are familiar with it. The problem is, it's only about 37% accurate according to studies at Penn State University. We're in an era of science where we actually can forecast the weather. And believe it or not, and I know some of you are like, yeah, right, we're about 90% accurate or more with weather forecasts, you just tend to remember the occasional miss. You do. So confirmation bias, Dunning-Kruger, and cognitive dissonance, I think those shape biases and perceptions that people have about science. But then there's literacy and misinformation that keep us boxed in as well. During the hurricane season of 2017, media outlets had to actually assign reporters to dismiss fake information about the weather forecast. That's the era that we're in. I deal with this all the time in social media. Someone will tweet a forecast. That's a forecast for Hurricane Irma, but here's the problem. It didn't come from the Hurricane Center. But people were tweeting and sharing this. It went viral. It didn't come from the National Hurricane Center at all. So I spent 12 years of my career at NASA before coming to the University of Georgia, and I chair their Earth Science Advisory Committee. I was just up there last week in D.C. And I saw some really interesting things. Here's a NASA model and science data from satellite showing the 2017 hurricane season. You see Harvey, Hurricane Harvey there? Look at all the dust coming off of Africa. Look at the wildfires up in northwest U.S. and in western Canada. There comes Hurricane Irma. This is fascinating to me, but admittedly, I'm a weather geek. But more importantly, it illustrates that we have the technology to not only observe the weather and climate system, but predict it. There's scientific understanding. So there's no need for some of those perceptions and biases that we've been talking about. We have knowledge. But think about this. This is Houston, Texas after Hurricane Harvey. Now, I write a contribution for Forbes magazine periodically, and I wrote an article a week before Hurricane Harvey made landfall saying, there's probably going to be 40 to 50 inches of rainfall. I wrote that a week before it happened. But yet, when you talk to people in Houston, people were saying, we had no idea it was going to be this bad. I'm just... a week before. But I know it's amusing, but the reality is we all struggle with perceiving something outside of our experience level. People in Houston get rain all of the time. They flood all of the time. But they've never experienced that. Houston gets about 34 inches of rainfall for the entire year. They got 50 inches in 3 days. That's an anomaly event. That's outside of the normal. So belief systems and biases, literacy and misinformation, how do we step out of the boxes that are cornering our perceptions? Well, we don't even have to go to Houston. We can come very close to home. Remember Snowpocalypse? Snowmageddon? Snowzilla? Whatever you want to call it? All 2 inches of it. 2 inches of snow shut the city of Atlanta down. But the reality is, we were in a winter storm watch, we went to a winter weather advisory, and a lot of people perceived that as being a downgrade. Oh, it's not going to be as bad. When in fact, the perception was that it was not going to be as bad, but it was actually an upgrade. Things were getting worse as the models were coming in. So that's an example of how we get boxed in by our perceptions. So the question becomes, how do we expand our radius? Area of a circle is pi r squared. We increase the radius, we increase the area. How do we expand our radius of understanding about science? Here are my thoughts. You take inventory of your own biases. And I'm challenging you all to do that. Take an inventory of your own biases. Where do they come from? Your upbringing, your political perspective, your faith. What shapes your own biases? Then evaluate your sources. Where do you get your information on science? Where do you read? What do you listen to consume your information on science? And then it's important to speak out. Talk about how you evaluated your biases and evaluated your sources. And I want you to listen to this little 40-second clip from one of the top TV meteorologists in the U.S., Greg Fischel, in the Raleigh-Durham area. He's revered in that region, but he was a climate skeptic. But listen to what he says about speaking out.
The mistake I was making, and didn't realize it until very recently, was that I was only looking for information to support what I already thought and was not interested in listening to anything contrary. And so I woke up one morning, and there was this question in my mind about, Greg, are you engaging in confirmation bias? Are you only looking for information to support what you already think? And if I was honest with myself, and I tried to be, I admitted that was going on. And so the more I talked to scientists and read peer-reviewed literature and tried to conduct myself the way I had been taught to conduct myself at Penn State when I was a student, it became very difficult for me to make the argument that we weren't at least having some effect. Maybe there was still a doubt as to how much, but to say nothing was not a responsible thing for me to do as a scientist or a person.
Greg Fischel just talked about expanding his radius of understanding of science. And when we expand our radius, it's not about making a better future, but it's about preserving life as we know it. So as we think about expanding our own radius in understanding science, it's critical for Athens, Georgia, for Atlanta, Georgia, for the state of Georgia, and for the world. So expand your radius. Thank you.
Meteorologist J. Marshall Shepard discussing three kinds of bias that shape your worldview and how you can replace them with something much more powerful, that being knowledge. Here on the WHFR Journal, I'm Alan Mazurek. We're going through TED Talks around the loose theme of climate change. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Lifelong Dearborn resident and HFC alumni, Gary Ciccarelli has illustrated everything from posters of Elvis to U.S. Treasury bonds to Disney posters to superhero trading cards, video games, toy boxes, board games, cereal boxes, Star Wars books, and many other products have featured his artwork. See his personal favorites now through March 15th in the McKenzie Fine Arts Center's Sisson Art Gallery, located here on the Henry Ford College campus. For more information, including gallery hours, please visit sisson.hfcc.edu. That's sisson.hfcc.edu.
It's the WHFR Journal here at 89.3, also online at WHFR.fm. I'm Alan Mazurek. Thanks for spending part of your Friday afternoon with us here at the station making waves. Susan McGraw has the week off, and we're spending our program today with TED Talks based around the subject of climate change. And we're going to continue in another vein talking about climate change and believing scientists and what they say with a TED Talk that came from a TED salon in New York in May of 2014. It's a talk given by Naomi Oreskes on the subject of why we should trust scientists. Many of the world's biggest problems require asking questions of scientists, but why should we believe what they say? Naomi Oreskes is a historian of science, and she thinks deeply about the relationship to belief and draws out three problems with common attitudes toward scientific inquiry and gives her own reasoning for why we ought to trust science. Here on the WHFR Journal.
Every day we face issues like climate change or the safety of vaccines where we have to answer questions whose answers rely heavily on scientific information. Scientists tell us that the world is warming. Scientists tell us that vaccines are safe, but how do we know if they're right? Why should we believe the science? The fact is, many of us actually don't believe the science. Public opinion polls consistently show that significant proportions of the American people don't believe the climate is warming due to human activities, don't think that there's evolution by natural selection, and aren't persuaded by the safety of vaccines. So why should we believe the science? Well, scientists don't like talking about science as a matter of belief. In fact, they would contract science with faith, and they would say belief is the domain of faith. And faith is a separate thing, apart and distinct from science. Indeed, they would say religion is based on faith, or maybe the calculus of Pascal's wager. Blaise Pascal was a 17th century mathematician who tried to bring scientific reasoning to the question of whether or not he should believe in God. And his wager went like this. Well, if God doesn't exist, but I decide to believe in him, nothing much is really lost. Maybe a few hours on Sunday. But if he does exist, and I don't believe in him, then I'm in deep trouble. And so Pascal said, we better believe in God. Or as one of my college professors said, he clutched for the handrail of faith. He made that leap of faith, leaving science and rationalism behind. Now, the fact is, though, for most of us, most scientific claims are a leap of faith. We can't really judge scientific claims for ourselves in most cases. And indeed, this is actually true for most scientists as well, outside of their own specialties. So if you think about it, a geologist can't tell you whether a vaccine is safe. Most chemists are not experts in evolutionary theory. A physicist cannot tell you, despite the claims of some of them, whether or not tobacco causes cancer. So if even scientists themselves have to make a leap of faith outside their own fields, then why do they accept the claims of other scientists? Why do they believe each other's claims? And should we believe those claims? So what I'd like to argue is, yes, we should, but not for the reason that most of us think. Most of us were taught in school that the reason we should believe in science is because of the scientific method. We were taught that scientists follow a method, and that this method guarantees the truth of their claims. The method that most of us were taught in school, we can call it the textbook method, is the hypothetical deductive method. According to the standard model, the textbook model, scientists develop hypotheses, they deduce the consequences of those hypotheses, and then they go out into the world and they say, okay, well, are those consequences true? Can we observe them taking place in the natural world? And if they are true, then the scientists say, great, we know the hypothesis is correct. So there are many famous examples in the history of science of scientists doing exactly this. One of the most famous examples comes from the work of Albert Einstein. When Einstein developed the theory of general relativity, one of the consequences of his theory was that space-time wasn't just an empty void, but that it actually had a fabric, and that that fabric was bent in the presence of massive objects like the sun. So if this theory were true, then it meant that light, as it passed the sun, should actually be bent around it. That was a pretty startling prediction, and it took a few years before scientists were able to test it, but they did test it in 1919, and lo and behold, it turned out to be true. Starlight actually does bend as it travels around the sun. This was a huge confirmation of the theory. It was considered proof of the truth of this radical new idea, and it was written up in many newspapers around the globe. Now, sometimes this theory or this model is referred to as the deductive nomological model, mainly because academics like to make things complicated, but also because in the ideal case, it's about laws. So nomological means having to do with laws. And in the ideal case, the hypothesis isn't just an idea. Ideally, it's a law of nature. Why does it matter that it's a law of nature? Because if it's a law, it can't be broken. If it's a law, then it will always be true in all times and all places, no matter what the circumstances are. And all of you know of at least one example of a famous law, Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, which tells us what the relationship is between energy and mass. And that relationship is true no matter what. Now, it turns out, though, that there are several problems with this model. The main problem is that it's wrong. It's just not true. And I'm going to talk about three reasons why it's wrong. So the first reason is a logical reason. It's the problem of the fallacy of affirming the consequent. So that's another fancy academic way of saying that false theories can make true predictions. So just because the prediction come true doesn't actually logically prove that the theory is correct. And I have a good example of that too, again from the history of science. This is a picture of the Ptolemaic universe, with the Earth at the center of the universe and the sun and the planets going around it. The Ptolemaic model was believed by many very smart people for many centuries. Well, why? Well, the answer is because it made lots of predictions that came true. The Ptolemaic system enabled astronomers to make accurate predictions of the motions of the planet, in fact, more accurate predictions at first than the Copernican theory, which we now would say is true. So that's one problem with the textbook model. A second problem is a practical problem, and it's the problem of auxiliary hypotheses. Auxiliary hypotheses are assumptions that scientists are making that they may or may not even be aware that they're making. So an important example of this comes from the Copernican model, which ultimately replaced the Ptolemaic system. So when Nicolai Copernicus said, actually, the Earth is not the center of the universe, the Sun is the center of the solar system, the Earth moves around the Sun, scientists said, well, okay, Nicolai, if that's true, we ought to be able to detect the motion of the Earth around the Sun. And so this slide here illustrates a concept known as stellar parallax. And astronomers said, if the Earth is moving, and we look at a prominent star, let's say Sirius, well, I know I'm in Manhattan, so you guys can't see the stars, but imagine you're out in the country. Imagine you chose that rural life. And we look at a star in December. We see that star against a backdrop of distant stars. If we now make the same observation 6 months later when the Earth has moved to this position in June, we look at that same star, we see it against a different backdrop. That difference, that angular difference, is the stellar parallax. So this is a prediction that the Copernican model makes. Astronomers looked for the stellar parallax, and they found nothing. Nothing at all. And many people argued that this proved that the Copernican model was false. So what happened? Well, in hindsight, we can say that astronomers were making two auxiliary hypotheses, both of which we would now say were incorrect. The first was an assumption about the size of the Earth's orbit. Astronomers were assuming that the Earth's orbit was large relative to the distance to the stars. Today we would draw the picture more like this. This comes from NASA, and you see the Earth's orbit is actually quite small. In fact, it's actually much smaller even than shown here. The stellar parallax, therefore, is very small and actually very hard to detect. And that leads to the second reason why the prediction didn't work, because scientists were also assuming that the telescopes they had were sensitive enough to detect the parallax. And that turned out not to be true. It wasn't until the 19th century that scientists were able to detect the stellar parallax. So there's a third problem as well. The third problem is simply a factual problem, that a lot of science doesn't fit the textbook model. A lot of science isn't deductive at all. It's actually inductive. And by that we mean that scientists don't necessarily start with theories and hypotheses. Often they just start with observations of stuff going on in the world. And the most famous example of that is one of the most famous scientists who ever lived, Charles Darwin. When Darwin went out as a young man on the voyage of the Beagle, he didn't have a hypothesis, he didn't have a theory, he just knew that he wanted to have a career as a scientist. And he started to collect data. Mainly he knew that he hated medicine, because the sight of blood made him sick, so he had to have an alternative career path. So he started collecting data, and he collected many things, including his famous finches. When he collected these finches, he threw them in a bag, and he had no idea what they meant. Many years later, back in London, Darwin looked at his data again and began to develop an explanation, and that explanation was the theory of natural selection. Besides inductive science, scientists also often participate in modeling. One of the things scientists want to do in life is to explain the causes of things. And how do we do that? Well, one way you can do it is to build a model that tests an idea. So this is a picture of Henry Cadell, who was a Scottish geologist in the 19th century. You can tell he's Scottish because he's wearing a deerstalker cap and Wellington boots. And Cadell wanted to answer the question, how are mountains formed? And one of the things he had observed is that if you look at mountains like the Appalachians, you often find that the rocks in them are folded. And they're folded in a particular way, which suggested to him that they were actually being compressed from the side. And this idea would later play a major role in discussions of continental drift. So he built this model, this crazy contraption with levers and wood, and here's his wheelbarrow, buckets, a big sledgehammer. I don't know why he's got the Wellington boots, maybe it's going to rain. And he created this physical model in order to demonstrate that you could in fact create patterns in rocks, or at least in this case in mud, that looked a lot like mountains if you compress them from the side. So it was an argument about the cause of mountains. Now, nowadays, most scientists prefer to work inside, so they don't build physical models so much as to make computer simulations. But a computer simulation is a kind of a model. It's a model that's made with mathematics. And like the physical models of the 19th century, it's very important for thinking about causes. So one of the big questions to do with climate change, we have tremendous amounts of evidence that the Earth is warming up. This slide here, the black line, shows the measurements that scientists have taken for the last 150 years, showing that the Earth's temperature has steadily increased. And you can see in particular that in the last 50 years, there's been this dramatic increase of nearly 1 degree centigrade, or almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit. So what, though, is driving that change? How can we know what's causing the observed warming? Well, scientists can model it using a computer simulation. So this diagram illustrates a computer simulation that has looked at all the different factors that we know can influence the Earth's climate. So sulfate particles from air pollution, volcanic dust from volcanic eruptions, changes in solar radiation, and of course, greenhouse gases. And they asked the question, what set of variables put into a model will reproduce what we actually see in real life? So here's the real life in black. Here's the model in this light gray. And the answer is a model that includes, it's the answer E on that SAT, all of the above. The only way you can reproduce the observed temperature measurements is with all of these things put together, including greenhouse gases. And in particular, you can see that the increase in greenhouse gases tracks this very dramatic increase in temperature over the last 50 years. And so this is why climate scientists say it's not just that we know that climate change is happening, we know that greenhouse gases are a major part of the reason why. So now, because there are all these different things that scientists do, the philosopher Paul Feyerabend famously said, the only principle in science that doesn't inhibit progress is anything goes. Now, this quotation has often been taken out of context because Feyerabend was not actually saying that in science anything goes. What he was saying was, actually this full quotation is, if you pressed me to say what is the method of science, I would have to say anything goes. What he was trying to say is that scientists do a lot of different things. Scientists are creative. But then this pushes the question back, if scientists don't use a single method, then how do they decide what's right and what's wrong? And who judges? And the answer is scientists judge, and they judge by judging evidence. Scientists collect evidence in many different ways, but however they collect it, they have to subject it to scrutiny. And this led the sociologist Robert Merton to focus on this question of how scientists scrutinize data and evidence. And he said they do it in a way he called organized skepticism. And by that he meant it's organized because they do it collectively. They do it as a group. And skepticism because they do it from a position of distrust. That is to say, the burden of proof is on the person with a novel claim. And in this sense, science is intrinsically conservative. It's quite hard to persuade the scientific community to say, yes, we know something, this is true. So despite the popularity of the concept of paradigm shifts, what we find is that actually really major changes in scientific thinking are relatively rare in the history of science. So finally, that brings us to one more idea. If scientists judge evidence collectively, this has led historians to focus on the question of consensus. And to say that at the end of the day, what science is, what scientific knowledge is the consensus of the scientific experts who, through this process of organized scrutiny, collective scrutiny, have judged the evidence and concluded, come to a conclusion about it, either yay or nay. So we can think of scientific knowledge as a consensus of experts. We can also think of science as being a kind of a jury, except it's a very special kind of jury. It's not a jury of your peers, it's a jury of geeks. It's a jury of men and women with PhDs. And unlike a conventional jury, which has only two choices, guilty or not guilty, the scientific jury actually has a number of choices. Scientists can say, yes, something's true. Scientists can say, no, it's false. Or they can say, well, it might be true, but we need to work more and collect more evidence. Or they could say, it might be true, but we don't know how to answer the question, and we're going to put it aside, and maybe we'll come back to it later. That's what scientists call intractable. But this leads us to one final problem. If science is what scientists say it is, then isn't that just an appeal to authority? And weren't we all taught in school that the appeal to authority is a logical fallacy? Well, here's the paradox of modern science. The paradox of the conclusion I think historians and philosophers and sociologists have come to, that actually scientist is the appeal to authority. But it's not the authority of the individual, no matter how smart that individual is, like Plato or Socrates or Einstein. It's the authority of the collective community. You can think of it as a kind of wisdom of the crowd, but a very special kind of crowd. Science does appeal to authority, but it's not based on any individual, no matter how smart that individual may be. It's based on the collective wisdom, the collective knowledge, the collective work of all of the scientists who have worked on a particular problem. Scientists have a kind of culture of collective distrust, this show-me culture, illustrated by this nice woman here, showing her colleagues her evidence. Of course, these people don't really look like scientists because they're much too happy. Okay, so that brings me to my final point. Most of us get up in the morning, most of us trust our cars. Well, see, now I'm thinking I'm in Manhattan, this is a bad analogy. But if you didn't, most Americans who don't live in Manhattan get up in the morning and get in their cars and turn on that ignition, and their cars work. And they work incredibly well. The modern automobile hardly ever breaks down. So why is that? Why do cars work so well? It's not because of the genius of Henry Ford or Carl Benz or even Elon Musk. It's because the modern automobile is the product of more than 100 of years of work by hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of people. The modern automobile is the product of the collected work and wisdom and experience of every man and woman who has ever worked on a car. And the reliability of the technology is the result of that accumulated effort. We benefit not just from the genius of Benz and Ford and Musk, but from the collective intelligence and hard work of all of the people who have worked on the modern car. And the same is true of science, only science is even older. Our basis for trust in science is actually the same as our basis in trust in technology, and the same as our basis for trust in anything, namely experience. But it shouldn't be blind trust any more than we would have blind trust in anything. Our trust in science, like science itself, should be based on evidence. And that means that scientists have to become better communicators. They have to explain to us not just what they know, but how they know it. And it means that we have to become better listeners. Thank you very much.
Naomi Oreskes and her talk, Why We Should Trust Scientists. It was given at a TED Salon in New York in May of 2014. I'm Alan Mazurek. We'll be back with more on the WHFR Journal in just a moment. Do stay with us.
Henry Ford College Theater collaborators are taking the show on the road. HFC adjunct theater instructor Jerry Zablinski is producing a two-hour modern dress production of Shakespeare's Hamlet, February 8th through 17th at Concordia University in Ann Arbor. The production is sponsored by the Kreft Arts Program in collaboration with the Experimental Performing Arts Association. The play's director, lighting designer, and six of the actors are all HFC alumni. Visit cuaa.edu/events. For more info.
I'm Alan Mazurek. It's the WHFR Journal here at 89.3, also online at WHFR.fm. And today on the program, we're tackling the subject of climate change through a series of TED Talks, things we like to do on this program every once in a while around a common theme, some ideas worth spreading from the folks at TED. And as always, the views and opinions expressed on the WHFR Journal are not necessarily those of WHFR, Henry Ford College, its Board of Trustees, although in this case they are the views and opinions of a vast majority of highly intelligent scientific minds when we talk about the concept of climate change. So take that for what it's worth. We're going to move next and actually listen to a lengthy TED Talk, which is pretty much going to take up the rest of the hour. And this one comes from Al Gore, probably an individual who is most responsible or highly responsible for bringing this issue to to the forefront through the film An Inconvenient Truth, which was a blockbuster of a film for a documentary, of course, released in 2006, which really brought the issue of climate change and global warming to the forefront. And I think arguably you could say also led to its politicization as an issue here in this country, simply because Al Gore, obviously a former vice president of the United States under the Clinton administration, obviously it led to some polarizing opinions that became a part of the discussion following the release of that film, at least in terms of popular culture. Anyway, so this goes back again a couple of years to, I think, February 2016, as a matter of fact. So 10 years after the release of An Inconvenient Truth. And Al Gore, in this case, is going to talk about the case for optimism on climate change. Let's listen now here on the WHFR Journal.
I was excited to be a part of the dream theme, and then I found out I'm leading off the nightmare section of it. And certainly there are things about the climate crisis that qualify, and I have some bad news, but I have a lot more good news. I'm going to propose three questions, and the answer to the first one necessarily involves a little bad news, but hang on, because the answers to the second and third questions really are very positive. So the first question is, do we really have to change? And of course, the Apollo mission, among other things, changed the environmental movement, really launched the modern environmental movement. 18 months after this Earthrise picture was first seen on Earth, the first Earth Day was organized. And we learned a lot about ourselves looking back at our planet from space. And one of the things that we learned confirmed what the scientists have long told us. One of the most essential facts about the climate crisis has to do with the sky. As this picture illustrates, the sky is not the vast and limitless expanse it appears when we look up from the ground. It is a very thin shell of atmosphere surrounding the planet. That right now is the open sewer for our industrial civilization as it's currently organized. We are spewing 110 million tons of heat-trapping global warming pollution into it every 24 hours. Free of charge, go ahead. And there are many sources of the greenhouse gases. I'm certainly not going to go through them all. I'm going to focus on the main one, but agriculture is involved, diet is involved, population is involved, management of forests, transportation, the oceans, the melting of the permafrost. But I'm going to focus on the heart of the problem, which is the fact that we still rely on dirty carbon-based fuels for 85% of all the energy that our world burns every year. And you can see from this image that after World War II, the emission rates started really accelerating. And the accumulated amount of man-made global warming pollution that is up in the atmosphere now traps as much extra heat energy as would be released by 400,000 Hiroshima-class atomic bombs exploding every 24 hours, 365 days a year. Fact-checked over and over again, conservative, it's the truth. Now, it's a big planet, but that is a lot of energy, particularly when you multiply it 400,000 times per day. And all that extra heat energy is heating up the atmosphere, the whole Earth system. Let's look at the atmosphere. This is a depiction of what we used to think of as the normal distribution of temperatures. The white represent normal temperature days, 1951 to 1980, arbitrarily chosen. The blue are cooler than average days. The red are warmer than average days. But the entire curve has moved to the right in the 1980s, and you'll see in the lower right-hand corner the appearance of statistically significant numbers of extremely hot days. In the 90s, the curve shifted further, and in the last 10 years, you see the extremely hot days are now more numerous than the cooler than average days. In fact, they are 150 times more common on the surface of the earth than they were just 30 years ago. So we're having record-breaking temperatures. 14 of the 15 hottest years ever measured with instruments have been in this young century, and the hottest of all was last year. Last month was the 371st month in a row warmer than the 20th century average, and for the first time, not only the warmest January, but for the first time, it was more than 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the average. These higher temperatures are having an effect on animals, plants, people, ecosystems. But on a global basis, 93% of all the extra heat energy is trapped in the oceans. And the scientists can measure the heat buildup much more precisely now at all depths, deep, mid-ocean, the first few hundred meters. And this, too, is accelerating. It goes back more than a century, and more than half of the increase has been in the last 19 years. This has consequences. First order consequence, the ocean-based storms get stronger. Super Typhoon Haiyan went over areas of the Pacific 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal before it slammed into Tacloban as the most destructive storm ever to make landfall. Pope Francis, who has made such a difference to this whole issue, visited Tacloban right after that. Superstorm Sandy went over areas of the Atlantic 9 degrees warmer than normal before slamming into New York and New Jersey. The second order consequences are affecting all of us right now. The warmer oceans are evaporating much more water vapor into the skies. Average humidity worldwide has gone up more than 4%, and it creates these atmospheric rivers. The Brazilian scientists call them flying rivers, and they funnel all of that extra water vapor over the land where storm conditions trigger these massive record-breaking downpours. This is from Montana. Take a look at this storm last August as it moves over Tucson, Arizona. It literally splashes off the city. These downpours are really unusual. Last July in Houston, Texas, it rained for 2 days, 162 billion gallons. That represents more than 2 days of the full flow of Niagara Falls in the middle of the city, which was, of course, paralyzed. These record downpours are creating historic floods and mudslides. This one is from Chile last year, and you'll see that warehouse going by. There are oil tanker cars going by. This is from Spain last September. You could call this the running of the cars and trucks, I guess. Every night on the TV news now is like a nature hike through the Book of Revelation. I mean, really, the insurance industry has certainly noticed. The losses have been mounting up. They're not under any illusions about what's happening. And the causality requires a moment of discussion. We're used to thinking of linear cause and linear effect, one cause, one effect. This is systemic causation. As the great Kevin Trenberg says, all storms are different now. There's so much extra energy in the atmosphere. There's so much extra water vapor. Every storm is different now. So the same extra heat pulls the soil moisture out of the ground and causes these deeper, longer, more pervasive droughts, and many of them are underway right now. It dries out the vegetation and causes more fires in the western part of North America. There's certainly been evidence of that, a lot of them. More lightning. As the heat energy builds up, there's a considerable amount of additional lightning also. These climate-related disasters also have geopolitical consequences and create instability. The climate-related historic drought that started in Syria in 2006 destroyed 60% of the farms in Syria, killed 80% of the livestock, and drove 1.5 million climate refugees into the cities of Syria, where they collided with another 1.5 million refugees from the Iraq War. And along with other factors, that opened the gates of hell that people are trying to close now. The U.S. Defense Department has long warned of consequences from the climate crisis, including refugees, including food and water shortages, and pandemic disease. Right now, we're seeing microbial diseases from the tropics spread to the higher latitudes. The transportation revolution has had a lot to do with this. But the changing conditions change the latitudes and the areas where these microbial diseases can become endemic and change the range of the vectors like mosquitoes and ticks that carry them. The Zika epidemic now, we're better positioned in North America because it's still a little too cool and we have a better public health system. But when women in some regions of South and Central America are advised not to get pregnant for 2 years, that's something new that ought to get our attention. The Lancet, one of the two greatest medical journals in the world last summer, labeled this a medical emergency now, and there are many factors because of it. This is also connected to the extinction crisis. We're in danger of losing 50% of all the living species on Earth by the end of this century, and already land-based plants and animals are now moving toward the poles at an average rate of 15 feet per day. Speaking of the North Pole, last December 29th, the same storm that caused historic flooding in the American Midwest raised temperatures at the North Pole 50 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal, causing the thawing of the North Pole in the middle of the long, dark winter polar night. And when the land-based ice of the Arctic melts, it raises sea level. Paul Nicken's beautiful photograph from Svalbard illustrates this. It's more dangerous coming off Greenland and particularly Antarctica. The 10 largest risk cities for sea level rise by population are mostly in South and Southeast Asia. When you measure it by assets at risk, number one is Miami, $3.5 trillion at risk. Number three, New York and Newark. I was in Miami last fall during the supermoon, one of the highest high tide days. And there were fish from the ocean swimming in some of the streets of Miami Beach and Fort Lauderdale and Delray. And this happens regularly during the highest high tides now, not with rain. They call it sunny day flooding. It comes up through the storm sewers. And the mayor of Miami speaks for many when he says it is long past time this can be viewed through a partisan lens. This is a crisis that's getting worse day by day. We have to move beyond partisanship. And I want to take a moment to honor these House Republicans who had the courage last fall to step out and take a political risk by telling the truth about the climate crisis. So the cost of the climate crisis is mounting up. There are many of these aspects I haven't even mentioned. It's an enormous burden. I'll mention just one more because the World Economic Forum last month in Davos, after their annual survey of 750 economists, said the climate crisis is now the number one risk to the global economy. So you get central bankers like Mark Carney, the head of the UK central bank, saying the vast majority of the carbon reserves are unburnable. Subprime carbon. I'm not going to remind you of what happened with subprime mortgages, but it's the same thing. If you look at all of the carbon fuels that were burned since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, this is the quantity burned in the last 16 years. Here are all the ones that are proven and left on the books, $28 trillion. The International Energy Agency says only this amount can be burned. So the rest, $22 trillion, unburnable risk to the global economy. That's why the divestment movement makes practical sense and not just is a moral imperative. Now, so the answer to the first question, must we change, is yes, we have to change. Second question, can we change? This is the exciting news. The best projections in the world 16 years ago were that by 2010, the world would be able to install 30 gigawatts of wind capacity. We beat that mark by 14.5 times over. We see an exponential curve for wind installations now. We see the cost coming down dramatically. Some countries, take Germany, an industrial powerhouse with a climate not that different from Vancouver's, by the way, one day last December got 81% of all of its energy from renewable sources, mainly solar and wind. A lot of countries are getting more than half on an average basis. More good news, energy storage from batteries particularly is now beginning to take off because the cost has been coming down very dramatically to solve the intermittency problem. With solar, the news is even more exciting. The best projections 14 years ago were that we would install 1 gigawatt per year by 2010. When 2010 came around, we beat that mark by 17 times over. Last year, we beat it by 58 times over. This year, we're on track to beat it 68 times over. We're going to win this. We are going to prevail. The exponential curve on solar is even steeper and more dramatic. When I came to this stage 10 years ago, this is where it was. We have seen a revolutionary breakthrough in the emergence of these exponential curves. And the cost has come down 10% per year for 30 years, and it's continuing to come down. Now, the business community has certainly noticed this because it's crossing the grid parity point. Cheaper. Solar penetration rates are beginning to rise. Grid parity is understood as that line, that threshold, below which renewable electricity is cheaper than electricity from burning fossil fuels. That threshold is a little bit like the difference between 32 degrees Fahrenheit and 33 degrees Fahrenheit, or 0 and 1 Celsius. It's a difference of more than 1 degree. It's the difference between ice and water. And in markets, it's the difference between markets that are frozen up and liquid flows of capital into new opportunities for investment. This is the biggest new business opportunity in the history of the world, and two-thirds of it is in the private sector. We are seeing an explosion of new investment. Starting in 2010, investments globally in renewable electricity generation surpassed fossils. The gap has been growing ever since. The projections for the future are even more dramatic. Even though fossil energy is now still subsidized at a rate 40 times larger than renewables. And by the way, if you add the projections for nuclear on here, and particularly if you assume that the work many are doing to try to break through to safer and more acceptable, more affordable forms of nuclear, this could change even more dramatically. So is there any precedent for such a rapid adoption of a new technology? Well, there are many, but let's look at cell phones. In 1980, AT&T, then Ma Bell, commissioned McKinsey to do a global market survey of those clunky new mobile phones that appeared then. How many can we sell by the year 2000, they asked. McKinsey came back and said 900,000. And sure enough, when the year 2000 arrived, they did sell 900,000 in the first 3 days. And for the balance of the year, they sold 120 times more. And now there are more cell connections than there are people in the world. So why were they not only wrong, but way wrong? I've asked that question myself. Why? And I think the answer is in three parts. First, the cost came down much faster than anybody expected, even as the quality went up. And low-income countries, places that did not have a landline grid, they leapfrogged to the new technology. The big expansion has been in the developing countries. So what about the electricity grids in the developing world? Well, not so hot. And in many areas, they don't exist. There are more people without any electricity at all in India than the entire population of the United States of America. So now we're getting this. Solar panels on grass huts and new business models that make it affordable. Muhammad Yunus financed this one in Bangladesh with microcredit. This is a village market. Bangladesh is now the fastest deploying country in the world, 2 systems per minute on average, night and day. And we have all we need. Enough energy from the sun comes to the earth every hour to supply the full world's energy needs for an entire year. It's actually a little bit less than an hour. So the answer to the second question, can we change, is clearly yes. And it's an ever firmer yes. Now, so last question. Will we change? Paris really was a breakthrough. Some of the provisions are binding, and the regular reviews will matter a lot. But nations aren't waiting. They're going ahead. China has already announced that starting next year, they're adopting a nationwide cap and trade system. They will likely link up with the European Union. The United States has already been changing. All of these coal plants were proposed in the last 10 years and canceled. All of these existing coal plants were retired. All of these coal plants have had their retirement announced. All of them canceled. We are moving forward. Last year, if you look at all of the investment in new electricity generation in the United States, almost 3/4 was from renewable energy, mostly wind and solar. We are solving this crisis. The only question is, how long will it take to get there? So it matters that a lot of people are organizing to insist on this change now. Almost 400,000 people marched in New York City before the UN special session on this. Many thousands, tens of thousands marched in cities around the world. And so I am extremely optimistic. As I said before, we are going to win this. I'll finish with this story. When I was 13 years old, I heard that proposal by President Kennedy to land a person on the moon and bring him back safely in 10 years. And I heard adults of that day and time say, that's reckless, expensive, may well fail. But 8 years and 2 months later, in the moment that Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon, there was a great cheer that went up in NASA's Mission Control in Houston. Here's a little known fact about that. The average age of the systems engineers, the controllers in the room that day was 26, which means, among other things, their age when they heard that challenge was 18. We now have a moral challenge that is in the tradition of others that we have faced. One of the greatest poets of the last century in the U.S., Wallace Stevens, wrote a line that has stayed with me: after the final no, there comes a yes. And on that yes, the future world depends. When the abolitionists started their movement, they met with no after no after no, and then came a yes. The women's suffrage and women's rights movement met endless no's until finally there was a yes. The civil rights movement, the movement against apartheid, and more recently the movement for gay and lesbian rights here in the United States and elsewhere. After the final no comes a yes. When any great moral challenge is ultimately resolved into a binary choice between what is right and what is wrong, the outcome is foreordained because of who we are as human beings, 99% of us. That is where we are now, and it is why we are going to win this. We have everything we need. Some still doubt that we have the will to act, but I say the will to act is itself a renewable resource. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Former Vice President Al Gore wrapping up this edition of TED Talks on the WHFR Journal with the case for optimism on climate change, a talk that was given in February 2016. That wraps up today's edition of the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. Stay tuned. Kitty Love will be up next with a trip down Highway 61. We'll be back next week with more on the WHFR Journal.
WHFR is having another benefit party, and you're invited. Join us Friday, February 8th at the Ghostlight in Hamtramck for our Motor City Gems party. Performing will be The Dirty News, Labor Day Weekend, and the Kenny Hill Group. The Kenny Hill Group, who's also featured on WHFR's indie rock compilation, Motor City Gems, an 11-song showcase on beautiful blue vinyl. In addition to the music, there will also be a 50-50 raffle and station giveaways, including a copy of Motor City Gems. So come out of the cold and join